Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In his new book, Legal But Lethal, public health researcher and professor Nicholas Freudenberg writes, quote, "Never before in the human history has the gap between the scientific and economic potential for better health for all and the reality of avoidable premature death been greater." End quote. Nicholas Freudenberg argues that six industries promote consumption at the expense of human health. Food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto have a greater impact on today's health than the decisions made by scientists and policymakers. He says those industries have become the main cause of premature and preventable illness and injuries in the United States, and corporations working in those industries are exporting diseases to the rest of the world. Governments around the globe, he argues, have stepped back and allowed for decisions that benefit corporate profit at the expense of public health. On today's Your Call, we continue our Agenda for a New Economy series by speaking with Nicholas Freudenberg about his new book, What Are the Best Ways to Improve Public Health and Deal with What He Calls the Corporate Consumption Complex. Nicholas Freudenberg is professor of public health at City University of New York School of Public Health and Hunter College, and founder and director of Corporations and Health Watch. It's an international network of activists and researchers that monitor the business practices of the alcohol, automobile, firearms, food and beverage, pharmaceutical, and tobacco industries. And Nicholas joins me here in studio. Hi, Nicholas. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me. It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. So you have worked in public health as a practitioner and an advocate for 3 decades. And you have some really great stories about how you and your colleagues have unsuccessfully tried to change a lot of things, and we'll talk about that. But first off, lay out your main argument for us, because you're basically pointing the finger at these six industries: food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto.
Yes, and the argument I make is there are two main causes of the growing world's health problems. One is chronic diseases, things like heart disease, cancer, stroke, diabetes, and the other is injuries from automobile accidents, firearms, and alcohol plays a role. And everywhere in the world, particularly in the developed world, but increasingly in the developing world as well, these causes of death are leading to an increasing proportion of preventable deaths and preventable injuries. And so I wanted to understand why that was. And there are some usual explanations of why we've seen these increases. And the most common one is it's about lifestyle. And I wanted to understand what are the causes of the changes in lifestyle over the last several decades. And what, from my research, I came to believe is that industry practices, both their business practices of product design, retailing, advertising, pricing, and their political practices, lobbying, campaign contributions, revolving door, bought scientists, philanthropy, have promoted what I call hyperconsumption, a pattern of consumption that is associated with premature death and preventable illness, and that in order to maintain profits, these industries are promoting a way of consumption that leads to very serious health problems. And unless we take this on, we're not going to be able to achieve our national health goals or our global health goals.
Talk about what we're really facing when we're dealing with chronic disease, because it seems like you hear of a new case of cancer almost every week. It's either a friend's mom or a friend of a friend or even a 25-year-old woman. And so what has changed over the past few decades?
Yes.
You say that these diseases like heart disease, cancer, diabetes account for more than 60% of the world's deaths.
Yes, and that's expected to increase significantly in the next 2 decades. And I think one theory for the increase in chronic diseases is simply population aging, and the other is our conquest of infectious diseases. And both of those things played a role. But what they don't explain is the earlier onset of chronic diseases that we're seeing today. diabetes in particular used to be an adult disease, and in fact it was called adult onset diabetes. But now we're seeing children, teenagers, young adults coming down with what we now call type 2 diabetes as a result of being exposed to what we call obesogenic environments, environments where too much sugar, too much fat, too much salt, too many calories is really ubiquitous, and it's much easier to make unhealthy choices than healthy choices. And that's really what these industries have done. They've made the default choice the choice that leads to disease. And that is literally insane public policy, to make the choices that lead to illness more accessible and easier than the ones that allow people to maintain their health.
You write that by 2050, it is predicted that 157 million Americans, almost one out of every two adults, will have one or more chronic diseases. And this is going to eat up about 75% of healthcare costs.
Yes, already we're spending three out of every four healthcare dollars on chronic diseases. And already 49% of our population has one or more chronic diseases. So it is the health challenge. And if we're going to be successful in implementing a national health plan, as the Affordable Care Act is moving us fitfully in that direction, we're really going to have to do something about chronic diseases. And that leads some people to say, you know, fix food first, fix tobacco and alcohol first, to stop the flow of people into our healthcare system. We know how to prevent chronic diseases, but so far we've lacked the political will to implement those solutions.
And so that takes us to these six industries that you say have a greater impact on today's health than the decisions by scientists and policymakers. And again, food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto. And a lot of people say, well, tobacco, didn't that happen a while ago? And haven't we already dealt with that?
Yes, that is a common really misperception. The estimates are in the 20th century, 100 million people died prematurely as a result of tobacco. But in the 21st century, 1 billion people around the world will die prematurely, absent very significant changes in the promotion of tobacco use. And so I think what the tobacco industry learned from our successes here in the United States, and there were important successes. We cut the smoking rates in half in the United States in four decades. But the lessons the tobacco industry learned were to use the same strategies, deceptive, manipulative strategies in Africa, Asia, and Latin America. And that's where tobacco-related disease is growing most rapidly. And if we're going to stop this carnage from tobacco, those are the nations that need to step forward to better control that industry.
You spoke recently at Stanford, and I understand you had an interesting conversation with a tobacco researcher. What did he tell you?
So, you know, the usual response of people to the argument that corporations have a responsibility for not promoting disease is that, well, individuals have a responsibility and individuals can choose not to smoke or eat unhealthy food. And of course, that's true. Ultimately, individuals need to make decisions. But I think the tobacco industry and the food industry and the alcohol industry have worked very hard to frame these questions as individual choices. And Robert Proctor, who is a historian who has studied the tobacco industry and written a wonderful book called The Golden Holocaust, has really noted how the tobacco industry worked very hard in the 1950s to promote that choice norm. When it became clear that tobacco was a lethal but legal product, their response, rather than making it safer, was to say, well, it's people's choice. They can choose to do that. Now, anyone who has seen a family member die from tobacco-related illness rues that choice. 90% of smokers in the United States wish they could stop. So, yes, people make the decision to light up, but then, like so many of these lethal but legal products, it's habitual habit or an addiction. And so the industries manipulate us in ways that undermine our health.
Well, how do you respond to the industries that say this is all about personal choice? People know the risk they're taking by smoking or maybe drinking multiple sodas a day. The science is out there. It gets a ton of media attention on a regular basis now. So it's up to the individual.
Well, I think there are a few things to say. First, the science is continually challenged by these industries. And that's true for all six industries. They've really taken the playbook from the tobacco industry of challenging science. One tobacco industry executive said, doubt is our product. And what they try to do is undermine what we know. And so, as you mentioned earlier, we have the knowledge, we have the scientific knowledge to dramatically reduce premature deaths. But the industry has been fighting in every arena, in the regulatory arena, in the legislative arena, in the courts, to prevent us from using that science to protect people. I also think the current thinking in public health is that we want to make healthy choices, easy choices. We want to create an environment where it's easy for people to choose health. But instead, the unhealthy products have become ubiquitous. It's much easier to find unhealthy food, especially in poor communities, than it is to find healthier food. You can find tobacco or alcohol anywhere. And there's a good body of research evidence that shows the more available these products are, the more likely people are to use them. I like the way that some community organizations and the tobacco control movement have reframed the question. So in the tobacco industry, I think there were two important reframings. One was, it's not the right for people to smoke or not smoke that's the main question. It's does everybody have the right to breathe clean air? Hmm. And when that argument was accepted, it was much easier to control tobacco. Another example of reframing the question came from a tobacco control group in Philadelphia, a group called the Stop Uptown Cigarettes Coalition. Reynolds Tobacco Company, one of the major tobacco companies, wanted to test market a new cigarette called Uptown that was going to be marketed to African Americans. And a community coalition formed of civil rights groups, church groups, health groups, and said, no, our community chooses to say no. You cannot market a product that's going to lead to early deaths among our children and young people, and we say no. And because Reynolds Tobacco was afraid that that campaign would go national, they chose not to market that product. It was a small victory, but it shows the power of reframing for communities to have a choice to say no to products that are going to undermine their health.
I'm speaking with Nicholas Freudenberg. He's professor of public health at the City University of New York School of Public Health and Hunter College, and founder and director of Corporations and Health Watch, an international network of activists and researchers that monitor the business practices of the industries that Nicholas believes are directly to blame for the public health crisis that we are facing today. And those industries are food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto. And he says that as the collective influence of these corporations have grown, governments are stepping back and allowing for decisions that benefit corporate profit at the expense of public health. So what do you think about Nicholas's argument that the blame should really be placed on these six industries, and there's far too much blame on individual responsibility? We need to really put our focus back on corporations. What are your thoughts on this? If you work in one of these industries, we'd love to hear from you. And if you're a public health professional, what are your thoughts on this? What changes have you seen over the past couple of decades, and how do these industries contribute to what we're facing today? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. When it comes to public health, what would you like to see changed, and what are some solutions? You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. So we'll spend more time talking about these industries, but you say that one of the main problems is that governments around the world have said, all right, you've got the power for many reasons, campaign contributions, the revolving door. Some of the people that work in these industries are now running the FDA, for example. And you've got this really interesting chart of national legislation and new agencies created between 1960 and 1980 to really regulate these industries and, frankly, protect citizens. So you've got everything from the Federal Hazardous Substances Act in 1960, Water Quality Act in 1965, Child Protection and Toy Safety Act in 69, so many different acts. You say that for sure they weren't adequately enforced, but this was a good start.
Yes.
So talk about the changes you've seen over the decades.
Sure. in the book, I trace the turning point for our current epidemics of chronic diseases and injuries to the early 1970s. And I think a document that crystallizes that is the so-called Powell Memo, written by Lewis Powell, who was a corporate lawyer who worked for the tobacco industry and the lead paint industry and other industries. And he wrote a memo to his friend at the Chamber of Commerce and to other fellow one percenters. And he said, look, guys, we need to man up. We need to respond much more aggressively to the criticisms that the environmental movement, the consumer movement, the women's movement are making about current capitalism. And we need to aggressively defend free markets. And he called for the creation of national organizations, think tanks, lobbying groups. And in a very remarkable way, his prescriptions have come to pass. And the laws that you mentioned that passed in the 60s and 70s, especially with the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980 and his dictum that government was the problem, not the solution, we saw government stepping back from regulating these laws, Congress from adequately funding. And that really created the conditions for these corporations to coalesce into what I call the corporate consumption complex, borrowing from Dwight Eisenhower's warning in 1961 about the military-industrial complex, which he said was a threat to our democracy and to our well-being. And today, I believe that threat comes from the corporate consumption complex, which promotes what I call hyper-consumption, a pattern of consumption that contributes to premature death and preventable illness and injury.
We often talk about, for example, the National Environmental Policy Act in 1970 under Richard Nixon, the EPA, the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, and a lot of our guests say that if these acts were just enforced, I mean, we don't really need new laws because these are pretty strong on the books. Mm-hmm. What are your thoughts about how these acts are enforced or not enforced today?
Yes. And notice that many of those were signed by both Democratic and Republican. There was a bipartisan support in the 60s and 70s that it was the responsibility of government to protect public health. And the corporations and their allies have really tried to undermine that and said they can be responsible for protecting public health. The market can do that, despite the absence of any scientific evidence that that's true. So I think what we see is that for a variety of reasons, the regulatory agencies, EPA, FDA, Consumer Product Safety Commission, they have dedicated individuals working within them, and they some of them are trying, some of their staff are trying to protect public well-being, but they're inadequately funded. They're also staffed by many revolving door employees who work for industry and then move to the agencies and then back to industry. I also think that increasingly the science that is needed to inform regulation is owned by industry, and they use intellectual property law to protect scientific discoveries. So the improvements in public health that we saw in the 19th and early 20th century came when science and technology was used for public well-being. That's what got us clean water, clean air, safer food. But now that science is being used to sell products that undermine our health instead of being used for the public good. It's really we need to insist on taking back that science, which in many cases the taxpayers have paid to support.
I'm speaking with Nicholas Freudenberg, author of the new book Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. He says that decisions made by six industries, food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto, have a greater impact on public health than the decisions made by scientists and policymakers because corporate profit is key, and governments are stepping back and allowing for decisions that benefit profit at the expense of public health. And Nick will be speaking tonight at UCSF 500 Parnassus Avenue in the Laurel Heights room, room 263, and he'll be speaking from 4 to 6 o'clock. And you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And let's take a few phone calls before we go to break. Let's hear from Sam in San Jose. Hi, Sam. Welcome to the show.
Hi, I'm eating lunch in the hospital parking lot.
Oh, Great. Hi.
I get the results of these six discrete groups. You know, you have the traumatic injuries. You understand. And I'm a speech pathologist doing it for 40 years. My point is that the thought precedes the action of food, tobacco, alcohol, guns, pharmaceuticals, and auto. And there's a common theme that is an industry that ties all these together, and that is the media marketing these items. And when you have relaxed people watching repetitive TV commercials, there's very scientifically designed end result for the person to want to smoke Marlboros to be a cowboy or drive a fast car to be like a NASCAR racer. You understand what I'm saying?
Yes, and I thanks.
And stay on the line, Sam.
Thanks, Sam. I agree that marketing plays a really important role. I think that marketing isn't separate from these industries. They pay for it. They design it. And the information released from the tobacco documents, the millions of documents that were forced to be released through the Attorney General's lawsuit against the tobacco industry and the Master Settlement Agreement, show that these industries work very carefully to design ads exactly as you describe, to get beneath our cognitive and rational processes, to appeal to emotions, even to appeal to primitive biological instincts. General Motors, for example, or Chrysler, hired a social anthropologist to help them design ads for SUVs. And that anthropologist urged them to appeal to their customers' reptilian instincts to protect themselves against threats by having a vehicle that could run over other people or escape from danger, even though SUVs are much more dangerous vehicles than sedans. So I think you're absolutely right. Marketing is very important, but that is controlled by industry.
And Sam, are you still there?
Yes.
So since you've worked in healthcare for 40 years, what are some of the most significant changes you've seen, and what concerns you the most right now?
Diabetes.
Have you just seen it explode over the years?
Well, you have more people with more severe impacting, more severe symptoms of diabetes, you know, amputation, etc., and being overweight, which impacts, because what you'll have is a diabetic who's an ex-smoker. They're on, you know, breathing apparatus and have wounds that are not going to heal, and they're morbidly obese, and they're impacting the health care basically based on choices they made. And a quick comment, I'm also a permanent resident of New Zealand. New Zealand, they tried to have the program Beavis and Butthead. Well, New Zealand banned it. Also, New Zealand, if you were in New Zealand and you buy a Coca-Cola for a child, people are going to start giving you strange looks and say, some people will actually come up and say, that's not appropriate for a child. Whereas in the United States, you're just going to see a child, you know, with fast food, happy on commercials. And so, in conclusion, I appreciate your time. The thought precedes the action. And the television, specifically, creates visual and auditory thoughts. And if you're, you know, a person who lives in an area where there is no healthy food, and all you see is, you know, fast food ads.
Right.
You don't have many other choices unless you're just a total renegade.
Yeah, I mean, that's the case in some cities not far from San Francisco. We're actually going to go to break, but the United States is still one of the only countries that has pharmaceutical TV ads, right?
Yes, there are a few other countries, but we are among the outliers in having direct-to-consumer ads.
I'm speaking with Nicholas Freudenberg, author of the new book, Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. If you work in public health, we'd love to hear from you. And if you work in one of these industries or have worked, food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto, what do you think about Nick's argument that they have a greater impact on health than decisions made by scientists and policymakers? It's your call. We'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on KALW San Francisco, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling 866-798-TALK. It's a toll-free call, 866-798-8255, or you can post your comment or question at yourcallradio.org, where you will also find links related to today's program. Coming up at 11 o'clock, live from the World Service of the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Following that, at noon today, Philosophy Talk with John Perry and Ken Taylor.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, Holly Kernan will have a conversation about how far the First Amendment should go for corporations. In November, the Supreme Court agreed to consider a religious freedom challenge brought by Hobby Lobby and other privately held companies objecting to the Affordable Care Act's requirement that it offers employees coverage for contraception and abortion services. So what are the questions before the court, and what First Amendment rights do corporations have, and how have they expanded? And then on Thursday, I'll have a conversation with Seth Holmes. He's out with a new book, Fresh Fruit, Broken Bodies. He traveled with immigrants as they journeyed from Mexico throughout California and other states to pick fruit and pick produce. So what questions do you have for Seth about how your produce is picked and what he found when he traveled with immigrants along the border? That's Thursday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we're joined by Nick Freudenberg, author of Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. Nick is professor of public health at the City University of New York School of Public Health and Hunter College, and founder and director of Corporations and Health Watch. It's an international network of activists and researchers that monitor the six industries he believes have greater impact on today's health and decisions by policymakers: food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto. And Nick will be speaking today from 4 to 6 at UCSF in the Laurel Heights Room 263. And we've got full lines, but we'll have one open in a few minutes at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And thanks again for calling in, Sam. Let's go next to Alex in San Francisco. Hi, Alex.
Hi. I think as long as we have a democratic government, whatever we have democratic governments, products like tobacco and guns, poison, lethal stuff, should not be out in the market and then argue about, oh, people have should have the right to make the decisions for themselves. Well, if they were not in the market, we wouldn't have to depend about people being idiots or wise people or whatever. So it should not be allowed in the first place. They have freedom of speech. There should be no freedom to insult anybody. What kind? This is like perversion. Perverts. We live in a pervert society, pervert governments. And there are people who try to make governments as if they are some alien concept. Government, as long as, again, we are in the democratic society, is our government. The Republicans, the rednecks, they try to put wedge between the people and the government.
Well, Alex, thank you for calling. And we're going to take a few more calls, and then we'll get a response from Nick in just a couple minutes. Let's hear from Tim in San Rafael. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thank you.
Good, good. This is terrific. I've been thinking about this all my life, and never put those six industries together, and so the scales have fallen from my eyes here in the past 20 minutes or so.
Glad to hear it. Thanks.
Yeah, good job. So my particular beat is I've sold alcoholic beverages for all of my life, which is a long time, and a couple of thoughts I have. One is the something that that drives me crazy, of course, 20 or so years ago, I believe the federal government finally got beer, wine, and liquor producers to put that drink responsibly note on all their advertising, and that has just degenerated to the point where I know there's one of the big horrible beer companies now. Their sign off on TV is, "With great beer comes great responsibility." So that's how diluted that message has come. That means nothing.
Wow.
You know, and I mean, and the original intention was, if you want to advertise, say something about, you know, please don't kill yourself with this product.
Huh. Well, you know, and
don't kill others.
Tim, I'm really glad you called in, since you worked in the alcohol industry. And Nick, because alcohol is one of the industries you point to, tell us why that one concerns you the most. And then I'd love to get your response, Tim.
Sure. here in the United States, alcohol is the third leading cause of preventable deaths, and it causes deaths both by contributing to a number of chronic diseases, most specifically liver diseases, but it also contributes to injuries, automobiles, firearms, and it's a leading trigger of all the kinds of violence, you know, domestic violence, suicide, and homicide. And again, I think I agree with a previous caller that democracy is the key issue, although I think the question are who decides what. And I'm not in favor of banning alcohol. I think there were certainly mixed results from our experience with prohibition. I think the questions are around promotion of patterns of use. And I think what we've seen with the alcohol industry is that they've really promoted use, especially to young people. And I have a quote in the book from the head of, I think, InBev, one of the big alcohol companies, saying, you know, we like to market responsibly. We don't need irresponsible drinkers. But the reality is they depend very heavily on those markets. There was an article in the journal Pediatrics that found that somewhere between 30% and 45% of the market of the alcohol industry comes from underage drinking and problem drinking. And so they really depend on those segments of the market, and they address them very heavily in their advertising.
We actually have an email from Monica who says, I would also like to address the way the alcohol industry targets young adults by making sugared up and flavored up alcohol. Young people drink this like they were drinking a smoothie. Even today's cocktails mask the taste of alcohol, and most young people have no idea of what alcohol really tastes like. She's talking about gin, vodka, rum, bourbon, etc.
Yes, some people call those alcopops, and one alcohol activist called them training wheels for drinkers. And I talk in the book about Diageo, which is the biggest alcohol manufacturer in the world, seeing declines in their sale of hard liquor in the United States and in other developed countries in the 70s and 80s. And so they decided they needed to find new audiences, and they looked to market to women and to girls.
Hmm.
And so they developed Smirnoff Ice. They hired Madonna and other media stars to market their products, and they saw that they made up for the decline in the adult male audience by recruiting young people to drink using exactly the types of products that your emailer mentioned. And what we're seeing from both alcohol and tobacco is a really perverse change in mortality patterns around women. So women always have lived longer than men. In 1970, they lived almost 8 years longer, and now it's less than five. And that shrinking of the gap between men and women has a lot to do with changing patterns of alcohol and tobacco consumption among women. And so the perverse solution to inequalities, gender inequalities in health, that the tobacco industry and the alcohol industry have imposed on us is to shrink the gap by shortening the lives of women. That's unconscionable.
So recently, the government announced a massive ad campaign to talk to teenagers about the effects of smoking. And a lot of public health advocates are cheering this on. When it comes to alcohol, what do you think should be done?
Well, I think in tobacco, we saw a very successful counter-advertising campaign led by the Legacy Foundation. That was the foundation created by the Master Settlement Agreement between the attorneys general and the tobacco industry. And their advertising was different from traditional public health advertising, and certainly the advertising that the tobacco industry sponsored. It didn't raise fingers and warn young people, don't do this, it's not good for you, you know, it's only for adults. That message, for any of us who have worked with teenagers, encourages them to do exactly what you're warning them against. And instead they said, don't be a chump. You know, don't be manipulated by an industry that's looking to get rich off your well-being. And I think that's the kind of hard-hitting campaign we need around alcohol. And it ought to be that local health departments and state health departments and the Health and Human Services ought to be sponsoring that kind of campaign. Don't be manipulated. Don't let the alcohol industry get rich off your health.
Tim, are you still with us?
Yes, I am.
So since you worked in the alcohol industry for so long, what are your thoughts on what Nick is saying, and how do you think an industry like that should be dealt with by the government? Do you agree with what Nick just said about some kind of public health ad campaign?
Well, it's got to be a multi-pronged approach to do this. I mean, you know, we've really done a good job with cigarettes in my lifetime, and I think that's heartening, because I think we could probably do that with alcohol too. Make people understand that they're using it incorrectly. In the case of cigarettes, it's probably incorrect to use cigarettes at all, but in the case of alcohol, obviously, in a lot of cultures, it's used, and it's part of the culture, and there aren't abuse problems. There aren't the abuse problems that we have in our culture. Another point, one quick thing, is it's pronounced Diageo, by the way.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Within alcohol, you need to differentiate between big alcohol, which is all spirits, the big breweries, and corporate wine, and the family side of it, the boutique wine and the craft beer industry, because that part of the industry is all about education, product knowledge, and responsible drinking fits perfectly in there. Absolutely. Diageo, I've been in their meetings, they're totally targeting underage drinkers. They don't say it, but it's obvious with their new products. I mean, let me just tell you. It's like, we all know it when we go out to sell. The fine wine industry and the craft beer industry, those are people who will listen to what the speaker has to say, and what consumers have to say. And consumers will hear that message from a wine brand that they trust or a beer brand that they trust. Unfortunately, there's really no boutique spirits, and that's a powerful message. Now you're getting to the kind of people who are easily made to think that way because they're more conscious.
Yes, I think you make a good point, but unfortunately, I think the trend in all three sectors of the alcohol industry is towards concentration, least so in the wine industry, as you mentioned. And I think that is an important battle to keep our eye on, and developing policies that allow a smaller craft boutique industry to survive and to develop different messages is important. But the global trends are towards consolidation. And what I've seen across the industries that I looked at is consolidation really encourages the promotion of hyperconsumption. It's easier to develop mass markets, to make highly processed products, and to advertise heavily, looking to vulnerable populations who can create that blockbuster product that these concentrated industries so depend on.
Well, thank you again for calling, Tim. And today we're speaking with Nick Freudenberg, author of the new book, Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. He says corporations have shaped and plagued public health over the last century, beginning in industrialized countries and then moving into less regulated developing regions. And he's specifically talking about corporations working in six industries: food, tobacco, alcohol, pharmaceutical, gun, and auto. And Nick will be speaking today from 4 to 6 at UCSF in the Laurel Heights Room 263. It's a free event, and you can find more information at yourcallradio.org. And let's go to our next caller, William in Belvedere. Hi, William. Welcome to the show.
Yes, thank you very much. First, I want to definitely say there is a lot of blame to be assigned to the industries that the author refers to. However, it's been my experience that when looking to assign blame, the first place is to look in the mirror before one does anything else. Now, many pension benefit plans, particularly large public benefit pension plans, such as I would imagine that the author is a member of, invest in exactly the industries of which he is critical. And I would appreciate his response to the following. Number one, does he know which of the industries his own pension benefit plan invests in? Number two, if he is, what has he done about it? And if he hasn't done something about it, is he troubled by what might be perceived as being hypocrisy?
We'll tell you what I know about this issue, and I think you make good points. In fact, some pension plans have taken steps in the right direction on this issue. CalPEP, for example, does not invest in tobacco. I belong to a pension plan of faculty members, and it does not invest in tobacco. And there was a big debate in CalPEP around divesting from the gun industry, and they approved that. I think social responsibility investing is one arena in which to have these fights. And I have talked with colleagues about creating professional organizations that urge universities, hospitals, pension funds to make an issue of the health practices of the industries they invest in. I think that is a viable strategy. I don't think it's been fully developed. There will be a lot of resistance, as there always are from investments, about making those decisions based only on market bases. And I think the political strategy is to make that a viable option, to give people the right to demand of their pension funds the opportunity to do that. But I think ultimately, it's a government responsibility to set the ground rules for corporations. And I think we also need to be active as voters, as citizens, in putting demands on our elected officials around campaign finance reform, around lobbying, around revolving door, to ensure that our government doesn't have conflicts of interest of putting the well-being of the public ahead of protecting corporate profits.
All right. Well, thank you again for calling in, William. Let's go next to Jack in Los Altos. Hi, Jack. Welcome to the show.
Hi. I don't know whether you were aware of predatory corporate practices. Recently, what surfaced was a renowned scientist at Tyrone Hayes at the University of California, Berkeley, was hired by agribusiness giant Syngenta to study its flagship product, atrazine, a widely used pesticide that is applied to more than half the crops in the United States and widely used on golf courses. Much to Syngenta's dismay, Hayes' research exposed the potential harmful effects on the endocrine system, leading to severe sexual abnormalities. And so the company was so fearful that the publication could hurt its bottom line that they attempted to purchase the data. When that failed, it launched a vigorous campaign to discredit Hayes' work. And then they hired people to embarrass Hayes and discredit his work at professional meetings. And then when that failed, they took a hard line, and then it really got ugly. And the poor man was faced with death threats that were made to his family. And then he was traumatized by all these relentless efforts to silence him. So he sought help from the Vice Chancellor for Research and the Dean, an Office of Legal Counsel, only to be told that he was on his own.
I actually read about this case. It's been written about, and I think it's a familiar pattern, you know, and not only for researchers but also for advocates. And as long ago as 1965, it's the same path that General Motors pursued when Ralph Nader first revealed some of the problems in General Motors product, a company that's again having problems mm-hmm. with the safety of its vehicles. So it's been a long time. And I think you point to a larger problem that is critically important, which is the independence of universities and their faculty to be able to investigate free of corporate interference. And I think the case you point to and other similar cases are indications that our universities haven't always done all they need to do to protect corporate researchers. Many universities accept corporate money and accept secrecy agreements that allow researchers and the industry sponsoring them to decide whether or not to release those data. And I think that is really contradictory with the spirit of academic freedom and free inquiry that we want for our universities. And as academics, as professionals, as researchers, we need to be holding our universities to account to protect academic freedom against corporate intrusion.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Jack. We had a question from Steve who couldn't stay on the line, and he says, what can U.S. citizens do about these corporations operating in other countries? And you have a really interesting section of your book, and you write that over the past four decades, the increasing globalization of multinational corporations forced U.S. companies to develop new strategies for increasing profits. This globalization of capital changed how U.S. companies interacted with the U.S. government, ultimately diminishing government influence on companies. Shortly before the start of the economic crisis in 2008, Business Week observed that, in effect, U.S. multinationals have been decoupling from the U.S. economy. They still have their headquarters in the U.S., they're still listed on U.S. stock exchanges, and most of their shareholders are still American, but their expansion has been mainly overseas. And you write, as economic pressures forced corporate managers to let go of patriotism that may have motivated earlier decisions, their concern for the well-being of the American people and its economy declined.
Yes, and that sheds a light on Mitt Romney's 2012 campaign statement that corporations are people too. If these corporations are not citizens, then why should they be protected, as I know you'll be talking about soon? Why should their rights, their constitutional rights to speak on political matters, which was not something the founding fathers addressed, be protected? And I think corporations have played an important role, especially through their trade associations, through the Chamber of Commerce, and through the organizations they've created, like ALEC and some of the so-called
the
think tanks.
Legislative Exchange Council,
right,
yeah.
Which has played a really important role in proposing state-level policies to allow corporations to enact laws that protect them at the expense of public health.
Why do you think this doesn't get more attention in terms of just how the corporations that are based overseas and the kind of business they're doing overseas? You know, we were talking about this earlier about how where are the jobs? That's a big question right now. But, I mean, you write about how these companies are exporting what they did here in the past mm-hmm. couple decades to now other countries. And are you talking about these six industries?
Yes, yes. And I think for all these six industries, their hope for the 21st century is low and middle income countries. And they're particularly interested in the so-called BRIC countries, Brazil, Russia, India, China, sometimes including South Africa. And it's actually the decisions that those countries make that will be critically important in whether the model of hyperconsumption that we've seen here in the United States is adopted worldwide. And I talk in the book in some of the more hopeful signs that the governments of Brazil, South Africa, and India have, on some occasions at least, been willing to stand up to multinational corporations. In the case of the drug industry, to issue what are called compulsory licenses, allowing national companies to produce drugs at an affordable price that the American and European companies aren't willing to do. And as a result, people with HIV infection, with diabetes in these countries have been able to afford medicines that would not be affordable if they had to depend on Merck and Pfizer and the other big global companies. So that's a positive thing. In Brazil, we've also seen some positive steps around their regulation of the food industry.
Well, so on the topic of being positive, I mean, there are so many debates right now about obesity, about food. I'm seeing so many stories about how animals are treated and the slaughter industry, healthcare reform, gun control. I mean, so many debates around these topics. Which area do you think has made the most progress and why?
Yes, I think the tobacco industry and the fight against tobacco has been going on the longest. And so we have 50 years, and we have, as I've discussed, great success here in the United States. Still a big problem, and still a cause of 480,000 premature deaths a year here in the United States.
Because Christopher in San Francisco just called in, and we're almost out of time, but he says, have the PSAs about smoking really made a difference with young people? He works with college kids in San Francisco and says he sees so many of them still smoking.
Yes, and I think the tobacco industry says they don't advertise directly to young people, but all the independent analyses suggests their ads are aimed at young people. And I think we need to do more. But I don't want to lose sight of the successes in reducing smoking, including among young people, and the imperative really around tobacco is to make this global. I'm very optimistic around food because I think there is a food movement. It's an emerging movement. The focus sometimes has been, to my mind, more on making more healthy food available, which is certainly important, and less on restricting the promotion and availability of unhealthy food, the processed food that big food companies make. That has to be a higher priority if we're going to succeed in reducing diet-related diseases.
And for people who care about this issue and want to fight back against these industries, what can they learn from the successes gained against the tobacco industry?
Yes, I think, first of all, there's no magic bullet. There's no single thing you can do. And in tobacco, we saw it was taxes. It was changing social norms. It was smoking restrictions. And I think we need to apply that multi-level response to these other six industries. I also think framing the questions as the rights of communities and individuals to make decisions to protect their health is another important message. A third message is to enact policies that do not allow corporations to pass the costs for the illnesses they generate on to the victims of those diseases and taxpayers. And by forcing companies to absorb those costs, it will not be profitable to promote unhealthy products as it is today. So those are important policy changes we should be working for.
So given the political realities we're facing, because just yesterday Republicans blocked a California campaign finance reform bill, it fell one vote short. I mean, that's here in California. Mm-hmm. So if you can't get campaign finance in California, well, you can get it in other states, but it's really difficult. So given the political realities that we're facing in terms of money and politics and the revolving door, what could you feasibly see happen? I mean, what would be at the top of your list?
Well, I see that health professionals and clinicians have a role to play in expanding that fight for democracy. It's not just about democracy. It's not just about equity and justice. It's also about our health. And if we worry about our children's health, if we worry about our parents' health, then we need to expand democracy. We need to create a more level playing field so that the future and current victims of these diseases can claim a voice in protecting ourselves and our families.
Nick Freudenberg is author of Lethal But Legal, Corporations, Consumption, and Protecting Public Health. He's giving a free talk today from 4 to 6 at UCSF in the Laurel Heights Room 263. Nick, thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
Thank you. And thank you for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. How far should the First Amendment go for corporations? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about the debate over corporations' rights to free speech and freedom of religion. Several corporations have objected to the Affordable Care Act mandate to provide employees with coverage for contraception and abortion services. The Supreme Court will hear this case this month. So what First Amendment rights do corporations have, and how have they expanded? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with Holly Kernan and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.